Signs of belonging. We've talked about belonging and how important it is for us to belong, to be isolated, not part of the group. We've seen that that can be ever so devastating and humiliating for a child, for not just for a child, but for all of us. At work, for example, if we feel that we're not appreciated, that we're not part of the team, it can completely demoralise us and prevent us from being effective. How much more so in the family of God? So it's very important to belong. An army, for example, that is just a collection of individuals, would be totally ineffective. Everybody does what he judges fit. Everybody goes off in all directions with no coherent plan or strategy. To this end, every army marks the belonging in several different ways. There's a uniform, drill and set pieces, war cry, martial music, a banner or a flag. So let's think of the army of Israel. They have been 38 years wandering in the desert. They had plenty of time to perfect these disciplines. They'd had skirmishes and battles in the desert and against the tribes that came up against them. And now they had just crossed the River Jordan and were ready to conquer the land. So what was Joshua thinking of? Camped in hostile territory, on the verge of a major campaign, after months and years of preparation and training with minor skirmishes and battles already notched up to their credit, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites. Imagine it. How do you think those Israelites felt the day after? To circumcise the army now would be just the opportunity those fearful Amorites would be waiting for. Hey, they've blown it. We were expecting them to come and attack us, and now what are they doing? They're sitting languishing in their tents. Let's get them. Let's nip this thing in the bud. It hardly made military sense, and the soldiers would likely be demoralized, anxious and bewildered. So logically, humanly speaking, it was totally the wrong thing to do, the wrong place, the wrong time, the wrong action. But this was not Joshua's idea. It was God who told Joshua to make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites. That quotation was not Joshua telling the people, it was God telling Joshua. See, the men of Israel had been circumcised when they left Egypt. They were part of the people of God. This circumcision was a sign that they belonged to the people of the promise. It was a sign that had been passed down from Abraham's day. We'll talk about that in a moment. But as we read in the text just now, the people who had gone through the desert, who'd been born in the desert, and who'd now crossed over the Jordan, they had not been circumcised. Now, where does this circumcision come from? Well, circumcision was practiced in other tribes, other nations, in fact, in other tribes even today, but it's not the same thing because they were usually puberty rites. This was a promise that God had given to Abraham, and it was a sign of that promise, that the promise of God was that Abraham would be the father of a great nation. They would inhabit a land of promise, a land flowing with milk and honey. And that through this nation, founded by Abraham, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. If you like, forget the Great Commission, the missionary chapter in chapter 28 of Matthew. They go into all the world and preach the gospel. That starts in Genesis 12. Right, that's an aside, Al, okay? It's not in the script. that through this nation the rest of the world would be blessed. Abraham, no childless, wife elderly, past menopause, believed the Lord. Incredible, eh? He believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Then two chapters later in Genesis, that was chapter 15 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 17, God comes along and he says, now, remember that promise I gave you? Now, I want all your males to be circumcised. That is going to be the sign. 8th day, every male in your family should be circumcised. That's going to be the sign of this promise I've given you. And it was also a sign of Abraham's faith. Paul, later on in the Romans, talks about this. He says, look, if you want to know the difference between being saved under the law, saved by grace, look at Abraham. He was saved by his faith 2 chapters before he was circumcised, 2 chapters before he was made a part of the people of God. But, as I said, during the wandering the desert, no baby boy had been circumcised. I've read commentaries that have speculated all sorts of reasons for this. To be honest, nobody knows, so I'm not going to speculate myself. But it did happen. And that meant that the present army, Joshua and Caleb accepted, because they had come out of Egypt and presumably then were circumcised. The present army had not received this sign of belonging. Forget the banners, forget the martial music, forget the uniform, forget the drills and set pieces. This was the sign that they should have possessed as being part of the people of God. And they had not received it. And so, before they start on the campaign of possessing that land of promise, they had to be part of the people of the promise. They had to receive the sign of circumcision. And so it was as important as uniform, as drill, as marching songs, as war cries or anything else. Or even the sergeant major bawling at them. So, why did Joshua circumcised the people on that very day, in that very place, at that very time? First, it was because God told Joshua to do it. Joshua obeyed God. Secondly, it was necessary to demonstrate that the Israelites were God's people. Thirdly, it reminded them of the promise that God had made to Abraham to inherit the land that they were about to conquer. Fourthly, they had to remember to trust God. This was totally ridiculous that they should be but circumcised at that time. But because God had said so, trust God, it will be all right, even if it didn't make sense. For us, there is a sign. We're not circumcised in our religion. That's Jewish. We undergo the rite of baptism. That also is an outward sign of our faith, of our belonging to the people of God. By baptism, we are received into the church, the people of God. By baptism, we declare that we are united with Christ in his death and in his resurrection. By baptism, we rise up into new life and live in the victory that Christ brings to us by his resurrection life. That for us is an equivalent sign. It doesn't make sense. Fancy being ducked under a tank of water, held down there until you can't breathe anymore almost, and then pulled up, gasping for breath. What sort of symbol is that? It's so graphic and it so demonstrates the resurrection of Jesus Christ, whose life now animates and fills us as we live for him. So moving on. They then celebrated the Passover. This was actually forbidden to anyone who was not circumcised. So they couldn't have done this before. So the first time they celebrated the Passover was when they left Egypt, and that was in a hurry. They slaughtered the lamb, painted the blood onto the doorposts as a symbol that these were the people who were to be preserved during the plague that followed. And then they ate this roast meat with some fine bitter herbs and some unleavened bread, because they hadn't had time to to let the bread rise. And then off they went on their long journey. Let's celebrate, say these people. Look at the time. Look at the date. It's the 14th of Nisan. Hey, doesn't that ring a bell? Yes, it's the first day of the first month, rather, of the Jewish calendar, of the Israelite calendar. That's the day when God commanded us to eat the Passover. Look, we're here. We're in the land at last. This is where we should celebrate the Passover. The conditions are right. We're now under God's approval. We have been circumcised. So let's celebrate the Passover. This time, they did not need a special command from God. God said, be circumcised. But here, it's the people taking the initiative. The command had already been given to them. It was in their law. Moses had written it out many years previously. Leviticus chapter 23. These are the Lord's appointed feasts, the sacred assemblies you are to proclaim at their appointed times. The Lord's Passover begins at twilight on the 14th day of the first month. And it's the 14th day of the first month tomorrow. Hey, let's get it all ready. Let's get it sorted. Let's celebrate. Let's have a Passover. The Passover, what was it? It was a feast of belonging. Everybody was included if you belonged to the people of God. But, of course, those who didn't belong, they didn't belong at the Passover table either. It was a feast of celebration. And even today, the Jews' Passover is a celebration. A feast of remembrance. Those, Joshua and Caleb, it was directly a feast of remembrance because they remembered the day they left Egypt. The others, they remembered having been told about it while they're on this long and arduous and terribly time-consuming journey in the desert. They remembered that God had delivered the people from Egypt. And so, for us, we also have a sign, a symbol, a celebration. We normally celebrate once a month on a Sunday morning, the first Sunday of the month, the communion, the Lord's Supper. This too is a feast of belonging. We belong together. We are invited to round the table by the Lord himself. A feast of celebration. Sometimes we sit there solemnly taking the bread and taking the wine, not saying a word, long faces. Sometimes I really enjoy those communion services where we are leaping around and singing and shouting and praising the Lord at the top of our voices. It doesn't happen that often in England, does it? But it happens in other parts of the world, and it's great. It's really great. To belong, something we share. I maintain that the Holy Communion is a service where we share together. So let's celebrate and praise the Lord out loud, singing together, praising the Lord out loud whenever we share communion together. It's a time of celebration. It's a feast of remembrance. We remember the fact that Christ died for us on the cross, and Christ gave his life, gave his body, gave his blood for us. And that is what we celebrate each time we celebrate communion together. Then something else happened. The manna stopped. What was manna? Well, if you remember, it was that funny kind of bread that the Israelites gathered miraculously every day during those 38 years of desert wandering. Nobody seems to know really what it was. Perhaps it was totally unusual and miraculous that nobody's ever seen before. What could have been a kind of resin that does sometimes appear on plants in the desert. But whatever it was God's provision for those people. Must have been provided in massive quantities every day. And it was there every day except Saturdays. Why? Because Saturday was the Sabbath and you couldn't have you going out in the fields to gather these when it was a day consecrated to the Lord. But the Israelites have been living on this for 40 years. Imagine. Didn't always appreciate it. They could do with a change sometimes, and sometimes they complained, and God did give them a treat when the quails came in. But this manna was what they lived on. It was God's provision. But now it had stopped. So God didn't provide for them anymore. Or did he? God's ongoing provision. God was going to provide in different ways. They ate some of the product of the land, as it says in the text. And for us, there's something here that's very relevant. I don't know how you perceive it. Do you perceive God providing for your needs? Or do you just say, well, I work hard for my living. I earn my crust. That's all down to me. I believe whether we receive a salary, a pension, or whether we rely on the uncertain, miraculous provision of the Lord directly for our daily needs, God provides for us. He may provide little, he may provide much, but it's God's provision for us. And it says in the text in Exodus, when they're talking about the manna, those who received little had enough, and those who received much had none left over. There was always just enough for each person. No doubt there would be some generosity, some sharing out, and some redistribution maybe. But Paul, for example, he in his lifetime experienced all these different forms of provision. Maybe not a pension. I don't think pensions existed in those days. But he was able to earn his living as a tent maker. He was able to receive gifts from the Lord's people. And just occasionally the generosity of the odd person, the official that he met from time to time when he was on his journeys. It is God who provides. Do we thank God for his provision day by day? And now the atmosphere changes. Something happened. I want you to imagine a film set. The music turns solemn, low droning notes, and not bang, bang, the drums occasionally beating in the background. The screen darkens. The scene becomes eerie. Joshua, he wanders out into the dusk, going on to an exploratory trip nearby Jericho, not far from Gilgal, where they were camped. The dark fortress walls that they so feared were looming in the gloom. And suddenly, a man bars his path, armed. What's Joshua going to do? Turn and run? No, he just went up to him and said, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" Hey, I admire his guts. But the reply he received drained all the blood from his face, all the courage from his system. An enemy combatant, Joshua could have managed. Perhaps a few sword thrusts and down he would go. But this man replied, "Neither. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Joshua, you might think that you're in charge. Think again. You're a subordinate officer. I'm the commander. You take orders from me." And what did Joshua do? He fell flat on his face in reverence. I think for us Christians, this is perhaps the hardest lesson that we have to learn. God is in charge. My part is to obey. No questionings, no discussion, no thinking, "Oh, is this really the best way? Perhaps there's another way we could do this." Or, you know, can't really commit ourselves that much. Or, where's it all going to come from? Or, if God says, do this, do it. So, to sum up, what are the lessons that we learn from this chapter? I think there's five or six. We belong not to a human organization, but to the people of God. What a privilege. What an amazing privilege. as far as we're concerned, the signs of belonging, not the trappings that often surround us, but the symbols that God has given us, baptism, the Lord's Supper, that remind us of his redemption and of his grace. Thirdly, God's way doesn't always make sense. It's important to do what he wants us to do. If he tells us to do something, rather than try to do things our way or in the way that seems right to us. Also, God does sometimes speak to us directly, but not necessarily. He has revealed his will in the Bible. And if we don't hear voices from heaven, if we don't hear voices coming behind us, telling us to do this, to do that, to go and make flint knives and circumcise the people, have a look in the Bible and see what he's got to say to us and do that. Because here is God's will for us. Of course, it's not always easy. Sometimes it needs interpreting. It needs contextualization, to use the buzzword, which means, have we really got to go and get flint knives out? No, of course we haven't, not these days, because something else has been put into place. We see that later on in the scriptures. Use a bit of intelligence, but with our intelligence we can see what God wants us to do. And if Jesus says to us, go and love your enemies, that's not contextualized, that is universal, and we should do so. And we have that responsibility to read and discover the Word of God. And so finally, let us just submit ourselves to God. Let us experience those spiritual battles, those enterprises that we engage in as individuals and also as a church. Let us do so in the submission to the will of God, seeking his direction, obeying his guidance, depending on his resources, and loving his way every day of our lives.